Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is The Big Breakdown. A long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
When Eric Richin's family stood to deliver their impact statements at sentencing, Corey Richin's rolled her eyes. She mouthed the words, "What? What?" Remember that? Just like... There was like a head shaking. There was kind of like the body goes up and it comes down. What? Almost like a little twist, like a sprinkler going back and forth. And the what out to the entire room, like an oscillating sprinkler of bullshit. She smirked. She made faces when her former sister-in-law described what losing Eric had done to the family. Even if you didn't do it, why are you smirking on someone talking about the loss of the person you supposedly loved, the father to your own damn children? You don't have to absorb it as you did it, but if you didn't in your mind, but smirking? Even if someone else did it in the Corey's mind, still, like... It was raw emotion for these people here who are feeling this loss. Oh, how are you able to do that? You have no empathy at all. You can't process things of that nature, and you can't feel things of that nature. That's why you come across to the rest of the world as a blithering fucking alien moron. She smirked. She made faces. She maintained that posture. Well, therapists read statements from her own children, children who described being locked in rooms and the basement, who said their mother had threatened to harm their pets, who said they were denied food, children who referred to her as Corey, not Mom, children who asked the judge for the harshest possible punishment. Contempt through all of it. Then the defense's turn came, and Corey's mother took the stand, her sister, her brother. They called her the glue of the family. And they said her innocence would shine too brightly to be contained, and Corey just dissolved, full visible, uncontrolled sobbing, just, oh, the adoration. The first genuine emotional display the courtroom had seen. From her throughout all of the trial, pain directed at her produced contempt. Praise directed at her produced tears. That behavioral spill tells you more about the psychology of Corey Richin's than any piece of evidence introduced at trial and everything that followed in that courtroom. The 45-minute address, the denials, the life advice, the promises had to be understood through that split. Because it reveals what triggers her emotional systems. Not suffering, not her children's fear, not the weight of what she was convicted of doing. Validation. Validation is the only signal that gets through. Everything else bounces off. May 13th of 2026, what would have been Eric Richin's 44th birthday, Corey stood at the podium in lime green. The lime green prison jumpsuit, that is, handcuffed, shackles around her waist, flanked by her attorneys because she wasn't a big enough girl to go on the stand and tell her story herself. She had to have three people all standing around her. You can do it, Corey. You got this, big girl. For the first time since before trial, she was allowed to speak, and everything that had been compressed behind 3 weeks of silence and a unanimous verdict came out all at once. What she said in those 45 minutes is the most complete psychological document this case has produced. More revealing than the Google searches, more revealing than the walk the dog letter, because this time it wasn't a hidden letter or a monitored phone call. It was Corey at a podium addressing a courtroom and three cameras, unfiltered by legal strategy, unchecked by counsel, telling the world who she believes she is. And if you've been with me through this series, if you've watched us break down the wiring, the compartments, the reflexes, the shutdown, this speech is where it all converges. This is the broken brain on full display with no one left to stop it. And what she chose to do with that moment tells you everything about what this psychology is ultimately for. She wasn't saying goodbye. She was planting seeds. She spoke directly to her sons. "I did not abandon you," she said. "I did not just walk out of your lives one day, never to return, never to call, never to show up, regardless of what anyone tells you. I would never, ever. And I am so sorry, regardless of what anyone tells you." His sons had just told the courtroom they were afraid of her. Their therapist read out loud their words. The children described a childhood that sounded like survival, and Corey's response was to tell them that the narrative they've been given by the family raising them is wrong, and their memories of being locked in rooms, wrong, the fear manufactured, their request for life without parole, the product of influence, not experience. In the same breath where she said, "I'm so sorry," she was telling her children that the things they're sorry about didn't happen the way they remember. That's not exactly comfort. That's an overwrite, an attempt to install her version of events inside her children's minds, even from a podium where she's about to receive life without parole. And the admission that surprised even people who'd followed the case closely. "I fell in love with someone who wasn't your dad," she told her sons. "Your dad fell in love with someone who wasn't me. I did things behind your dad's back. He did things behind mine. Don't keep secrets. Always put your spouse first. And then our love never failed." She admitted to the affair and neutralized it in the same sentence. Why? Because both of them did it. It cancels out in Corey's mind. No, there's no evidence of his actual affair, but, you know, if Corey says it out loud, it makes it true in her world. And despite everything, the infidelity, the financial chaos, the insurance manipulation, the prenuptial battles, the living trust Eric created specifically to protect his assets from her, their love never failed. The marriage that ended in murder described as an enduring love. The audience can hear the contradiction. The judge can hear it. Corey can't. Because the contradiction only exists if you hold both truths in the same frame. And her psychology was designed at the most fundamental level to prevent that from ever happening. "God did not put me in this world to take a life." That sentence is not an evidentiary claim. It's an identity claim. Not "I didn't do it," but "I am not the kind of person who could do it." She's not arguing facts. She's arguing essence. The person the jury convicted does not exist. The person standing at this podium is incapable of what the verdict describes. Therefore, the verdict is wrong. Not because the evidence was insufficient, because Corey Richards, as she understands herself, is not a killer. The logic is circular, impenetrable, and entirely sincere. As much as you've been influenced into thinking that Dad was murdered, take, or that I took your dad from you, that is completely wrong. An absolute lie. Directly to her children, on camera, in a courtroom. The unanimous verdict, the 3 weeks of evidence, and the lived experience of the people raising those boys, all of it, an absolute lie. She told three traumatized children that the reality confirmed by 12 jurors, a judge, forensic evidence, and their own statements to therapists is fabricated. And she said it with the emotional conviction of someone delivering an important truth. But the line that matters most, the one that will outlast the trial, the verdict, the sentence, and probably Corey herself, came near the end. Looking at her son, she said, "Never apologize for something you didn't do. Never admit to something you didn't feel. And never beg for mercy for something you didn't do." It's not really a statement. It's an instruction, a piece of code transmitted from a mother to her children in the last public moment she'll may ever have with them. And its function isn't comfort or wisdom or even denial. Its function is recruitment. She's telling three boys, boys who are afraid of her, who asked for life without parole, who describe a childhood of being locked in basements and denied food, to adopt her defiance as their own. Be like mom. To carry it forward, to never accept the reality that 12 jurors, a judge, and their own therapist, what they confirmed. She isn't saying goodbye to her children. She's enlisting them. Planting a seed she hopes will generate and germinate over years, over decades, until one day those boys look back and wonder if maybe their mother was right. If maybe the system was corrupt, if maybe what they remember isn't what happened. And people like Corey love folks that they can bamboozle to think their way. They don't care who they destroy in the process, as long as there's another voice backing up their chaos. That's what the speech was for. Not the judge, not the gallery, not the camera, the boys. Because the boys are the only audience that matters now. They're the only people on earth who might, in 10 or 15 or 20 years, be persuadable. Everyone else has heard the evidence and rendered judgment. But three young minds, traumatized, confused, missing their father, and frightened of their mother, those are minds where a seed can still take root if you water it long enough. According to reporting, Corey sent her children a message. The cards and letters will never stop. I will never stop. Can't stop, won't stop. Even though the kids just begged you to stop. That's the missing statement right there. The mission statement. Not I love you and I'm sorry. Not I hope you find peace. Not any of that. It's I will never stop. The letters will keep coming from prison for years, for decades, each one carrying the same message. Your reality is wrong. The people raising you are misleading you. Your mother was innocent. And one day you'll understand. This is where this entire psychological architecture was built. And what it was built for, not the murder, not the insurance money, not even the self-preservation. At the deepest level, this kind of psychology in Corey exists to perpetuate itself. It needs believers. It needs an audience that accepts the constructed reality as true. And when the adults in the courtroom, the jury, the judge, the public rejected that reality unanimously, the psychology pivoted to the only audience left, three children, who didn't yet have the tools to evaluate exactly what they were being told. Judge Richard Marzek sentenced Corey Richens to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He noted the sequence, the Valentine's Day attempt, the 17-day escalation, the completed act, and said a person convicted of those things is simply too dangerous to ever be free. The sentencing fell on Eric's birthday. It would have been 44. His sons, all under 14, had asked the court through their therapist for the harshest possible punishment. One of them wrote that after his father died, Corey would put us in the basement while she was with the neighbor. They called her Corey, not Mom. The question that haunts every person who has followed this case is whether she knows, whether somewhere underneath all of it, she knows what she did. And the honest answer is, it doesn't matter. Not for the boys. Whether Corey is performing innocence or genuinely experiencing it makes no functional difference to three children who will receive letters from prison for the next 40 years telling them their father wasn't murdered and their fear was manufactured. The psychological damage is identical either way. The seed gets planted either way. The childhood that should be dedicated to healing gets interrupted over and over by a voice from behind bars insisting that the healing itself is based on a lie. That's what I hope keeps coming back. to not Corey, the boys. They realize what's happening here. Three kids who lost their father to fentanyl poisoning, who described a childhood of punishment and control to a therapist who read their words in open court, who asked a judge to make sure their mother could never come home, have already endured more than most adults will face in a lifetime, and who now face a future where the woman convicted of killing their father will write to them consistently, persistently, for as long as she's alive, telling them none of it happened. I hope they have the strength to keep their walls up. She'll never apologize, never admit, never beg for mercy. That's the inheritance she left them from that podium. Not love, not remorse, not the grace of a mother letting go so her children can heal. A command, a recruitment pitch disguised as life advice. The last act of a psychology that could not, even in its final public moment, prioritize someone else's pain over its own survival. Eric Richens deserved a wife who saw him as a person, not a payout. His boys deserve a future that isn't haunted by letters telling them their own memories are lies. They deserve to grow up in homes with open doors and honest conversations and adults who tell them the truth, even when it's ugly. They deserve to build their own lives, not lives defined by the architecture of the woman who took their father. Maybe that's the reason to tell the story, not to understand Corey, not to decode the pathology or map the architecture or trace the reflex, but to see it clearly enough that those boys and anyone else who's ever been on the receiving end of this kind of mind can recognize it for what it is. That's what the series has been about. Not necessarily diagnosing her, not excusing her, breaking down the decision-making process of a broken brain so the rest of us can see the pattern. So the next time someone encounters it in a marriage, in a family, in a relationship, they can't quite make sense of, they don't spend years trying to understand something that was never going to make sense by any normal rules. Not love, not devotion, not a mother who can't let go. A machine that only knows how to run. And three boys who deserve more than anything in the world to be free of it. If you have found yourself or recognize yourself in the position of those boys, you deserve it too. Go. Take it. Escape. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. And we'll continue our conversation right there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts so you don't miss any of our episodes on this and the many cases we follow for you right here at the Hidden Killers podcast. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Everyone asks the same question about Eric Richens, the deceased husband of Corey Richens, that thing back there. The second they hear the details of the case, the same five words show up in every comment section, every group chat, every conversation, at every kitchen table where someone is catching up on what happened in Park City, Utah. Why didn't he just leave? It's the wrong question. And it's the wrong question in a way that matters, because asking it assumes that leaving was the safe choice and staying was the dangerous one. For Eric Richens, that math, the math, it ran the other direction. He didn't stay because he was blind to what Corey was. He stayed because he saw it clearly, more clearly than the friends around him, more clearly than the systems that were supposed to help him. And he concluded that leaving would put his kids closer to the danger, not further from it. He wasn't a man who didn't see the fire. He was a man standing between the fire and his three boys. convinced that if he stepped away, the fire would reach them. That calculation is what the story is really about. Not what Corey did. What it was like to live inside the world she built, to see it for what it was, and decide that the safest place to stand was still inside of it to protect his kids. Before we can understand why Eric stayed, we have to understand what happens inside a person who's holding two completely incompatible truths at the same time. On one side, the person is trying to kill me. On the other, this is my wife, the mother of my children, the person sitting across from me at breakfast, the other half of the carpool. Your brain is not built to carry both of those at full volume. One of them has to get turned down. And inside a marriage, inside a home with three young boys, inside a life that still looks like a life to everyone on the outside, the threat is almost always the one that gets quieter. Not because you forgot, because you can't really function if you don't. As we go through this, if you've been in a situation like this, male, female, whatever it may be, if you had a monster like Corey in your life, a narcissistic, sociopathic, cluster B monster like Corey Richens, in my opinion, share your story. A lot of people are finding community within this and going, this hits home. I'm not alone, because you're not. I've survived it. Many other people have survived it as well. And there is life out there. You do not have to stay in this situation. And you also don't have to end up dead by a Moscow mule in your bedroom. But let's understand. Let's understand how he ended up on the floor of that bedroom, overdosed with fentanyl by his loving wife, Corey, and why he chose to stay. Greece, in this case, is the first evidence. Years before Eric died, the couple took a trip overseas. Corey gave Eric a drink. He became violently ill. Ill enough to pick up the phone and call his sister from another country and say the words out loud, "I think my wife just tried to kill me." That sentence spoken to family with a clarity that only comes from genuine fear. And then he came home. They resumed. Years passed. That phone call didn't disappear from Eric's memory, but it got reclassified. A bad night on vacation, a scare that didn't repeat, because the alternative that the woman raising your children just tried to end your life is something the brain will fight long before it accepts. It wasn't weakness. It was the only way to keep getting up in the morning inside a situation he hadn't yet left. Then came Valentine's Day of 2022, and whatever wall Eric had built between those two versions of his life cracked in a way the rest of us can actually see. Corey left Eric his favorite sandwich from a local diner, handwritten note, a Valentine's gesture, supposedly. He took one bite and his body went into revolt, hives, throat closing. Grabbed his son's EpiPen, took some Benadryl, passed out for several hours. When he woke up, he texted Corey that he wasn't feeling well, that he might need to go to the hospital. She told him to take a nap. The woman who just left the sandwich that did that. After he recovered, he called two friends, and here's where it gets important, not because of what happened, but because of the two completely different stories Eric told about the exact same event. One friend, Allie Staking, later testified that Eric described the sandwich incident almost like a funny story, an allergic reaction, something they were laughing about together. His other friend, Josh Kreis, got a completely different call. Kreis testified that Eric was somber, serious, and Eric's business partner, Cody Wright, said he could hear fear in Eric's voice. Eric told the last one of these people directly, or at least one of these people directly, he thought his wife was trying to poison him. Same event, same man, same afternoon. Two entirely different versions of reality, both coming out of the same mouth, and neither one was a lie. Eric wasn't performing for staking. He wasn't being dishonest when he laughed about it. He was accessing the version of his life where things are still okay, where a sandwich is just a sandwich that made him sick, where his marriage is rocky but survivable. When he called crazy and right with fear in his voice, he was in the other version, the one where he'd done the math and the numbers didn't come out in his favor. That's what living inside sustained danger in a home does to a person. It makes you fluent in two languages. One is for the world where your life is still your life. One is for the world where it isn't. And the reason the normal version keeps muscling its way to the front is because the alternative, spending every waking minute in the reality where the person next to you in bed is trying to end you, isn't something a human being can sustain. You can't function there. You can't coach your son's games, run a masonry business, do the things a life is made of while carrying the full weight of what you believe is happening. So the brain toggles. It lets you be terrified on the phone with the friend who can handle it, and it lets you laugh about it with the friend who can't. And that toggle doesn't just help you get through the day. It helps you stay, because the normal half keeps whispering that maybe the scared half got it wrong. Maybe grease was just a bad drink. Maybe the sandwich was just a sandwich. Maybe. But Eric didn't ride the split passively. He acted. And what he did next is the part that breaks the why didn't he leave question into pieces, because Eric did everything a person in his position is supposed to do, short of walking out the door. His brother-in-law, Clint Benson, helped him find a divorce attorney. Christina Miller, who testified at trial, sat down with Eric to talk through what a divorce would look like, how to protect his finances, custody. The meeting happened separately. Eric worked with an estate planning attorney to rewrite his will. He formed the Eric Richens Living Trust and put everything under his sister, Katie Richen Benson's control for the benefit of his three sons. He changed his power of attorney. He moved his life insurance beneficiary from Corey to Katie. Every single step done in secret. Corey had no idea any of it had happened. So here's a man who called his sister from Greece years ago and said his wife tried to kill him, who nearly died eating a sandwich on Valentine's Day, who told at least two family members he believed Corey would kill him for money and wanted to make sure the kids were financially taken care of, who told his family directly, if anything happens to me, she's to blame, who hired a divorce attorney, who rewrote his will, who restructured his entire estate to keep it away from the person he feared most, and who still went home every night, still slept in that house, still ate the food and drank the drinks. The part most people miss, preparation can become a substitute for departure. Every move Eric made, the attorney, the trust, the will, gave him something the brain craves when it is trapped. A sense that you're doing something. You ever been in a situation, a high-stress situation? Drama comes into your life unexpectedly, and you find the only thing you can do to deal is keeping yourself distracted in some way, shape, or form. Maybe cleaning the house compulsively. Going through your clothes. Getting into the old storage unit and emptying it out. It makes you feel productive. It makes you feel like you're getting somewhere outside of where you are currently trapped. A sense that you're doing something, handling it, building a plan. That feeling of forward motion is real, but it can actually push the exit further away when you're checking boxes. Met with the lawyer, changing the beneficiary, restructuring the estate. Your brain registers progress. It says we're moving. We're getting somewhere. And that feeling of momentum can keep the one action that would actually change your safety, leaving, always on the horizon instead of on today's list. The preparation starts to feel like the thing. The plan becomes a replacement for the act. I say it from experience. I've been there. I've done that. It gives you a little bit of respite, a moment of relief when you're sitting there, okay, if this happens or if something happens, here's how we can handle it. But again, you're missing the trees before the forest sometimes. And then look at what Eric actually protected, the money, the business, the life insurance, the boy's financial future. He built a wall around everything Corey would try to take after he was gone. He didn't build a wall around himself. That's not an oversight. That's a tell. At some point, Eric stopped planning how to get out and started planning what would happen when he didn't. The threat had been in the house so long it stopped being an emergency and started being weather. You don't prevent weather, you prepare for it. And that shift from I need to escape to I need to make sure the kids are covered when this catches up to me, that's the clearest evidence of what sustained danger does when it lives in your home long enough. Your own death stops being something to prevent and becomes something to manage around. And those who have been there probably don't even realize that's what one was doing. Because in the moment, you're not thinking that. It's hindsight and a retrospective look at it that makes that little fact shimmer in the light. But Eric's decision to stay wasn't rooted in denial or exhaustion or even the slow weight of having lived with this too long. The real reason is worse. And it's in the testimony his sister Katie gave at sentencing. Katie said she begged Eric to leave. His sister Amy said the same thing. He had the attorney, he had the legal groundwork, he had his family ready to catch him. He could have gone. And Eric told Katie he had already talked to the divorce attorney, that he was deeply afraid he wouldn't get sole custody, that he had made what Katie called the heartbreaking decision to stay because he could not accept the risk of what might happen to his sons if Corey had equal custody. He told his sister he would live his life through hell every single day until his youngest was 18 because he believed Corey was the most evil person he had ever met. That's not a man in denial. That's a man who did the cost-benefit analysis of his own life and decided his safety was the variable he was willing to give up because he was a good father. He believed, and a jury would eventually confirm that Corey was dangerous. But family courts don't convict people of future crimes. Eric couldn't prove what he knew. He couldn't walk into a courtroom and say, "My wife is going to kill me, potentially the children too," and have that turn into sole custody. And the thought of his boy spending weeks, holidays, unsupervised weeks with the person he believed was capable of anything? That was a price he would not pay. Not even with his own life. And there are plenty of parents out there watching right now that know exactly what I'm talking about. His identity as a father, as a protector, as the one who held everything together, that identity was both the most admirable thing about him and the thing that kept him in reach. Being the buffer between Corey and the boys meant staying close enough for Corey to get to him. The protector role didn't have a version where the protector left the room as long as Eric was in the house. He believed he was the safety system, the barrier between her and them. If he walked out, the barrier walked out with him. That logic made sense to Eric. It would make sense to a lot of people listening. And it was the exact logic that kept him in the position for the night of March 3rd when Corey handed him a Moscow mule to celebrate a property deal and he drank it. And you know, we can't see into the future. We can't see where this path might have gone. Should Eric have said, enough. Kids, you get to take your chances with her. I got you half the time. She's got you half the time. I can't change it. It's what the law says. But I'm out. He didn't do that because he's a loving dad. Because he cares to protect. And Eric knew something about Corey that no one else did yet. That she's a killer. That she had the potential to do this kind of violence. And he was right. He was dead right. And he paid for it with his life. And he stood between her and the kids. And that was the cost. But who's dead today? It ain't the kids. It's Eric. If Eric had walked away, who would be alive today? Would those three boys be? I think that's a big if. Corey likes to hurt other people. Corey only finds validity in breathing by making her scarlet mark on all those who come in her path. I think it's a real big if that her children would still be alive, all of them still be alive, if Eric had walked away. Eric's calculation may have been exactly right. He unfortunately paid for it with his life. In doing so, he did protect his children. All while trying to navigate a system that has a real hard problem. Identifying dangerous people, dangerous control, and dangerous ideas until it's far too late. He stayed with her because the system wouldn't allow him to walk away and keep his children safe. Eric wasn't the only person living inside the world Corey Richens built. Everyone around him was processing the situation through the same broken lens. The friend who heard the Valentine's Day sandwich story as comedy, the defense attorney who told 48 Hours that Eric and Corey were probably at the best place they had ever been with their marriage and seemingly genuinely happy. The family who knew everything, begged him to leave and couldn't physically remove a grown man from his own house when he said no. The courts. I don't have a category for my spouse is trying to kill me, but hasn't succeeded yet, so I can't prove it. Nobody around Eric was negligent. The situation was just so far outside anything they had a framework for. When your friend tells you he had a bad reaction to his sandwich, you don't call the police. When your brother says he's afraid of his wife, but won't leave because of the kids, you tell him to leave. And when he doesn't, you don't have a next move. The people who loved Eric the most could see the room he was in. They just couldn't pull him out of it. But the room actually felt like from the inside, not from Eric's side, but from the boys who were living in it, didn't come out until sentencing. And it's a piece that reframes everything. One of Eric and Corey's sons recalled the night his father died. He was put to bed early without a bath, which apparently wasn't normal. When he tried to go to his parents' bedroom, his mother yelled at him to go away. He later told investigators that his mother didn't sleep in his room that night, directly contradicting what Corey told police. A child catching the cracks in his mother's story in real time on the night he lost his father. At sentencing, all three boys said they'd be afraid if Corey were ever released. One son, now 13, said he was afraid she'd come after him and his brothers, that she'd not do good things to us, like hurt us. Another said he feels hateful and ashamed when people talk about his mother because she took away his dad. The youngest said that once she's gone, he'll feel happy, safer, relaxed, and trust more people. And then one of the boys said this, "I miss my dad, but I do not miss how my life used to be. I don't miss Corey." Eric stayed in that house to protect his children from the damage Corey would do with unsupervised custody. He believed his presence was the buffer. He believed he was the safety net. And his children's own words, spoken to a judge after all of it was over, tell you what the environment actually felt like while Eric was fighting to hold it together. They don't miss how life used to be. They feel safer now with their father dead and their mother behind bars. And they did, or then they did, when both parents were in the house. The normal Eric was trying to preserve wasn't protecting anyone. It was the thing they all needed to be rescued from. Corey Richens didn't just take Eric's life. She built a world where the person who saw her most clearly was the person least able to escape. That world, the one where danger became weather, where fear and laughter lived in the same afternoon, where a man restructured his will instead of packing a bag because leaving felt more dangerous than staying. That world is the real crime scene, and the boys Eric gave everything to protect had to lose their father before anyone could pull them out of it. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. And if you have a story of survival, we'd love to hear it as well. We'll continue the conversation there. The links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe if you're finding our reporting valuable. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
What's up, Boos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.